Hi, everybody. My name is Greg Hancock, and along with my improbably awesome friend, Patrick Curran, we make up Quantitude. We're a podcast dedicated to all things quantitative, ranging from the relevant to the completely irrelevant. In today's episode, we play with some of the basics of probability in the context of some classic, fun, and often counterintuitive examples. Along the way, we also mention arguments with relatives, a feel for the roulette wheel, Xeroxing your butt, the coin has spoken, Bull Club, the Bellagio fountains, Clooney and Pitt lookalikes, the Flippier, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, Monty Hall, Ferraris and goats, the birthday problem, how to carve an elephant, pick six lotteries, and the University of Michigan football stadium. Go Blue. We hope you enjoy today's episode.
You like parties about as much as I like parties.
It is just about the lowest circle of hell for me.
I am right there with you. Let me ask you a question. When you're at a party, and let's go ahead and narrow it down to a family event.
Okay.
Do you take it upon yourself to talk about things like politics or religion with family members?
I don't. It doesn't matter if they're family members or otherwise. I would like to come away from this still having some shred of liking of other people. And so I try to avoid those kinds of topics.
So I never engage people about big ticket stuff like that in an extended family party kind of way. Mm-hmm. I broke my own rule over the holidays by talking about something incredibly serious with an extended family member, and I've regretted it ever since.
Uh-oh.
And it involved not religion, not politics, but probability. Which I found out it would have been easier to talk about the Middle East than it was to talk about probability. So let me set the stage.
Uh-huh.
I'm in Colorado. I'm with extended family. I'm with an elderly gentleman to whom I am related.
Okay.
And there's a little town up in the mountains, about 45 minutes northwest of Denver, called Blackhawk. And it's a beautiful little old mining town, but there are casinos there.
Okay.
And they run buses from the retirement homes to go up to Blackhawk.
Today, Blackhawk is a popular tourist destination known for its casinos, historical sites, and beautiful scenery.
This family member of mine routinely goes up to gamble, and his favorite game is roulette. And I'm like, oh, that sounds like fun. I'm not a gambler. I went to Vegas once, and I kid you not, this was back when you used to have quarters in your pocket. And I walked in, and I stuck a quarter in the very first slot machine, pulled it, didn't get anything. I fished out another quarter, stuck it in, and didn't get anything. And I thought, this is the dumbest thing I've ever seen. And I just decided to walk up and down the strip.
Uh-huh.
The grand total of money I have lost in gambling is 50 cents. And so I was interested, and I said, well, that's one of the gambling games that is truly chance. Right. You can get into this whole thing of what are games of chance? Is poker a game of chance?
Mm-hmm.
Is blackjack a game of chance? And they're actually not, because you have information available to you. But roulette is purely chance. And he looked at me with this very angry look. And he said, no, it's not. And I said, what? What? And I was like, no, it is. You spin the ball and it just falls in a hole. And he said, with total disdain and contempt, well, maybe it's chance to people who just walk up and put their money down without watching it first. And I could just feel myself being pulled out. And I bet. And I was like, what do you mean if you observe? And he said, well, you've got to get a feel for the wheel. And you have to watch and get a sense of what's happened. And this is going to tell you how to bet on that. And again, one is, I would have been okay with that. But his contempt for people who didn't do that, these yokels who just come up and put money down.
Idiots.
And I said, well, no, it's a truly random process. And we got into this very pointed conversation about probability.
Uh-huh.
And people started coming around and joining us. And it wasn't the Middle East. It wasn't should there be a pope or not. It was, well, what is the probability of an event without informative information versus what is the probability of an event with informative information? And the whole thing went south and he just stormed off angrily.
Because of the big city ideas you got about probability. Yeah. I mean, the only question that really leaves me with was this a relation by marriage? So everybody out there knows probability comes up in things every day. It comes in the prediction of the weather. It comes in your insurance policy. It comes in sports. It comes in games. And when people talk about probabilities, there are different ways to think about them. There are certainly subjective probabilities. Like if I ask you, what is the probability the Chicago Cubs are going to win the World Series? What answer would you give me?
-0.2.
You are perfectly equipped to have the probability conversation with your family members. Yeah, right. So that would be an example of, a crappy probability, but a subjective probability.
Don't be judgy about my probability. You said it was subjective.
I'm sorry. I apologize. You're right. This is a genetic issue, you've made clear. So yeah, there are subjective probabilities where people bring some degree of content knowledge or expertise to something and give you a probability. What if I hand you a new coin? Nobody has ever seen this coin before. And I ask you, is this a fair coin? How would you evaluate whether or not that's a fair coin?
I would flip it a million times and count the proportion that came up heads.
There you go. That would be an example of empirical probability where we don't necessarily know what's going on, but we gather so much data that we feel that we're homing in on that. Are coins actually fair, by the way, the ones that we typically use?
There is such a fun little thing. There is a published research article that claims a flip of a coin is not 50-50. Mm-hmm. It is 0.508 that whatever side is facing up when you flip will be up when it lands. Hmm. This is a real study. I have no idea if it was done correctly. I have no idea if it generalizes. Well, I mean, it's, you know, not like I Xerox my butt and put it on the internet and now I'm going to list it on my resume. This was a peer-reviewed paper.
Uh-huh.
But for all intents and purposes, we can assume 50-50. Unless we're a child of yours.
Well, okay.
No, please. Let's do a little aside in how to lie and manipulate your children.
Yeah. Did I mention this before? I don't know if I did or not, but a 50-cent piece is a coin that's not in circulation a whole lot anymore, but it's half a dollar here in the U.S. And I have developed the ability to flip the coin, catch it, and make it come up on the side that I want. And this has solved so many problems in my house where kids didn't know what they should do or what. And I'd be like, hey, let's just leave it up to chance. Flip it. And then I go, okay, well, heads, I guess you're going to do your homework now. You know, and the kids had this refrain, the coin has spoken. And
is this why they struggle with AP stats?
Yeah, all the coin flip stuff is messed up for them. All right. So in that experiment that you described where someone determined 0.508 was the probability of a particular event occurring, we could call that empirical probability. But like you said, for all intents and purposes, we're going to be focusing on assuming that things are equally likely, and we're just going to deal with what historically has been called classical probability. And classical probability, the idea is that you enumerate all of the possible options that are out there to define a space of possibilities, and then you figure out within that space, how often does your thing occur?
There are floors of libraries dedicated to probability. So two things. One is we're just going to have a bit of fun with it here while you're driving to or from work or doing whatever you're doing now. And the other is we can take all the architecture of probability and really distill it down to how many things are you interested in occurring and how many total things can occur. And we're just going to put one in the numerator and one in the denominator. And that is probability.
That's it.
All right. And so a roulette wheel is scaled from 0 to 36. And so not worrying about black and red and even and odd and high and low, there are all these ways you can bet on roulette. The probability that the ball is going to land in one of those bins is 1 in 37, because there are one thing that you're interested in, and there are 37 possible outcomes, because it's 0 to 36. All right, that's probability. Actually, do we need to do any more? I think that's kind of the episode. So, you know what? We're getting close to spring break.
Okay.
And we're going to have Quantitude Book Club, but it's spelled with a Q. All right. Book with a Q and club with a Q. And you know what? They're going to share a Q.
Book Club.
And the assignment for this week is to read Hunter S. Thompson's Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. Hunter S. Thompson is a hero of mine, and he's this counterculture 1960s, 1970s journalist, but he founded what he called gonzo journalism, where you weave in your own experiences with the journalism, with fiction, and with a lot of LSD. That's a really important part of it. But I think we should take a Fear and Loathing trip to Las Vegas for spring break and play with probability in Las Vegas. All right, Greg is still giving me this look. He's like, dude, where are you going with this?
I'm still stuck on the spelling of book club. But anyway, I know you said some stuff after that.
You are assigned to read Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. It's brilliant. And so Greg and I are going to go to Vegas on acid. And we are going to talk about probability.
Again? Oh, my God. Okay, road trip to Vegas. Here we go.
I don't care if the sun don't shine. I do my drinking in the evening time when I'm in Las Vegas.
Do you have a favorite casino in Vegas?
Oh, God, no. I haven't been there in like 20 years. But I love Ocean's 11, and the final scene of Ocean's 11 is outside the fountains of Bellagio.
Yeah.
So we're going to go to the Bellagio.
Okay, excellent choice. And by the way, excellent movie recommendation.
Okay, I want to be George Clooney. You can be Brad Pitt.
Okay.
All right?
All right.
We get this a lot.
No, we don't. But okay, let's go with it. So we go into the Bellagio, and just to keep things simple, let's go to the coin flip table. I assume they have a coin flip table.
You've never been to Vegas, have you? We go to the coin flip table. Okay, so you and I are slow motion walking through the casino, looking an awful lot like Clooney and Pitt, and we go up to the coin flip table.
That is so badass. Clooney and Pitt, on acid.
On acid.
Going up to the coin flip table. All right, help me out with some things. Just basic stuff. Got a fair coin, probability of a head.
0.5. You're interested in one thing, two things could happen. 1/2 is 0.5.
That's right. And those two things that could happen are equally likely. So what about the probability of flipping heads and then heads again in two coin flips?
All right. So we're going to invoke a thing called independence, which means that the outcome of the first thing doesn't impact the outcome of the second thing. Mm-hmm. All right, we could compute this two ways. If it's independent, it's 0.5 times 0.5, because you got to get ahead on the first one, which is a 0.5 probability. You got to get ahead on the second one, which is a 0.5 probability. So it's 0.25, 0.5 times 0.5. But if you think about it as a numerator and denominator, in how many ways can a head-head happen? Well, just one way. You can only get ahead and then ahead. The pair of them can only happen in one way. What are all the possible outcomes? Well, you could have a head, 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 tail, tail, head, tail, tail. So there are four possible outcomes. 1/4 is 0.25.
I like that. Two great ways of thinking about it. I love that you listed out the entire space of possibilities. All right, so then what's the probability on two coin flips I get one that's heads and one that's tails?
Well, what's interesting is notice that he said you get one head and one tail. He's saying order doesn't matter here. One of the flips is a head, one is a tail. Well, think about it. How many ways can you get that? Well, you could flip a head and a tail, or you could flip a tail and a head. So there are two ways you could get that, but we actually have the same sample space. Head, 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 tail, tail, head, tail, tail. So it's 2/4. We're back to 0.5.
That makes total sense. All right, so now let me mess with your mind a little bit while we're here at the coin flipping table at the Bellagio.
On acid.
On acid. I know that it's the croupier in...
So it's the flippier. We're going to have the flippier. That's French for flipper.
Okay. Oh, the flippier. The flippier has flipped two coins and has covered them up from my view, but peeks at them and tells me a piece of information and says, one of those coins I'm looking at is a tail. And so now I'm going to ask you, given that information, what is the probability that both of those coins are tails?
All right. Your gut feeling would be there's a 50-50 on the first, a 50-50 on the second. Multiply them, it's 25%, same thing. And that is where your subjective feeling is going to betray you. Because let's think about that numerator and the denominator. What is the possible outcome? And what is the space of things that could happen? Well, we have a tail, and the outcome is we want tail-tail, mm-hmm. right? So there's one outcome that we're interested in. So we have to think about the total possible number of outcomes. Well, because there's a tail, and because there's a tail-tail is what we're interested in, our possible outcomes now are not four, they're three, because we could have a tail-tail, a tail-head, or a head-tail. We can't have a head-head because the tail already happened. So it is 1/3.
That's right, because this is a conditional probability. Given the condition that at least one of them is a tail, what is the probability that both of them are tails? So there's a whole space of equally likely things, one of which is that particular outcome. All right, so when I gave you that example, I said that one of the coins that the flippier was hiding from you was tails. Now I'm going to add order to this, where the flippier flips a first coin, and we all know that it is tails. We see that it comes up tails. And now I ask you, what's the probability that the next flip is tails?
50-50, because they're independent.
But it already came up tails. Haven't we used up tails now? How? Why doesn't that matter?
Because you asked me, what is the probability the second coin would be tails? You didn't ask me the probability they would both be tails. So they're independent events, and we can pull a Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead. All right? We're going to have another assignment on book club. The second book you have to read is Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are Dead by Tom Stoppard. And it is brilliant. And there's a movie that is even more brilliant.
That's fantastic. Right?
We now have a movie club that is also spelled with a Q.
With a Q.
It is just wonderful from start to finish. The point is there's a very famous scene out of there where the two guys are riding their horse. One of them finds a coin on the ground and starts flipping it. And it is heads, 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 heads. And the scene goes on and on.
Heads. 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 Heads.
And then they have this wonderful conversation about probability and philosophy of life.
A weaker man might be moved to re-examine his faith. If in nothing else, at least in the law of probability. Consider. One, probability is a factor which operates within natural forces. Two, probability is not operating as a factor. Three, we are now held within un, sub, or supernatural forces.
And then he flips it.
I feel the spell about to be broken.
And it comes up heads, and he shrugs, and he says,
well, it's an even chance.
So they are independent, and so you can tell me the first coin landed on its side. You could tell me the first coin bounced off and rolled down the Bellagio drain. I don't care. If they're independent, there's a 50-50 chance that it'll come up tails.
So if it is a fair coin, not it's not me flipping it. If there's a fair coin and someone has 73 heads come up in a row, and I ask you, what is the probability of the next one being tails? You're going to still stick with your answer, right? You're going to still say 50-50 because what happened before doesn't matter.
That's exactly right.
So then I've been sitting next to this roulette wheel, watching it, studying it. And I notice that a 13 hasn't come up in a really long time. So what's the chance that a 13 comes up next?
1/37th.
What would your kinfolk say?
this is a form of the gambler's fallacy, is if there have been 10 rolls of the wheel and 13 has not come up on any of the 10, it's more likely to come up now because it's due to come up.
Right.
And that is in part the gambler's fallacy and why people lose their entire retirement savings in Vegas, because they think that they can win it back.
Ever wonder where your grandparents might be spending their time and money these days? Well, you might want to check your local casino.
There's no better place for this to be demonstrated than if you go to the slot machines and the octogenarians are there fighting each other for the machines that haven't paid off in a while.
That's right.
Because they believe that that machine is due. And there will be heated arguments, or people will be very possessive of their machines. They will commandeer multiple slot machines simultaneously. It is a culture that is completely built on this idea that this is due to pay off because it hasn't paid off in a while. It's fascinating.
And they wear gloves.
Yes.
I'm not kidding.
Yeah.
They wear gloves to protect against blisters. Yeah. And you go to the machine that hasn't paid off because it's due. And when a machine pays off, everybody goes away from it because it's not going to pay off again in a while.
Yeah.
Now, one thing I hate about slots is those are controlled by electronics and they're all electronic now. When I have that brutal day where I lost 50 cents and I will carry that with me with shame for the rest of my life, they were mechanical.
Yeah.
And now they're all digital. I can't see the randomness because it's in a computer.
Right.
But when you throw die, when you spin the ball at roulette, when the flippier goes, ha, 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 it is a heads.
I like the image of someone going all in at the coin flipping table.
Put it all on heads, man. Put it all on heads.
Baby needs a new pair of shoes.
But that is no different than craps.
Yeah.
Right? That is no different than I'm all in on Snake Eyes, Boxcar Willies, a Natural 7.
Yep.
It's exactly the same thing. It's just a little more complicated because instead of a head over a tail, you've got a sum of two die. Each one can be from 1 to 6. But everything scales up and down. If you throw a pair of fair die and it's a pair of ones, they're called snake eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And you throw another pair and it's a snake eyes. And you throw another pair and it's snake eyes. What is the probability the next throw is going to be snake eyes? Well, it's 1 in freaking 36. Because there's a 1 in 6 chance on the first one times a 1 in 6 chance on the second one. This scales up and down all the games of chance.
That's right. All right, so if we're thinking about probabilities, there's a crazy famous probability question that has to do with these outcomes. You want to tell us about that?
Oh, boy. Are you talking about Monty Hall?
Yeah. Do we dare mention it?
I love Monty Hall problem. There's a wonderful history to it because some very famous people got it wrong. So there was a game called Let's Make a Deal, and Monty Hall was the host. And it was just an afternoon game show that when you pretended to be 6 so you didn't have to go to school, you could watch that.
Let's make a deal. And now here's America's top trader, TV's big dealer, Monty Hall.
And here's the scenario. All right, now it's pinned back to 1975 in an article in the American Statistician by Steve Selvin. But people claim it goes way, way back, like 100 years back. So this is a classic problem that's kind of contemporized with this Let's Make a Deal. All right, it's really simple. You're a contestant on Let's Make a Deal. So you walk up to the stage and you're facing 3 doors. Behind one of the doors is a Ferrari. Behind each of the remaining doors is a goat. And all the doors are 1, 2, and 3. All right, now, given what we learned about roulette and the flippier, ho, 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 what is the probability? I'm asking you, Greg, what is the probability when you're allowed to choose one of the doors that you pick the Ferrari?
I'm going with 1 and 3.
Because?
There are 3 options there. Assuming there's no reason to pick one over the other, no additional information, they all seem equally likely to me. So 1 in 3 shot.
That is right. They are unconditional. You have no added information to act on. Now, Monty Hall says, I'm going to open door number 3 and there's a goat. So now, let's say you pick door number 1. Door number 2 is closed and door number 3 has a goat. Do you stick with your original? Do you switch? Or does it not matter?
Ooh.
All right, now, before you answer, this was posed in the American Statistician. It kind of went by the pencil necks, all said, oh, that's interesting. And it showed up in a newspaper article called Ask Marilyn. She had a very engaging article that would address these kind of puzzles and problems, and people would write in and things like that. And somebody wrote this in, and she answered and gave the right answer. And people came out of the woodwork of proving her wrong.
There were some pretty heavy hitters.
There were heavy hitters who said what a moron Marilyn was for getting it wrong. And she was right. All right. So now, listeners, think about it. You chose door one. Door two is closed. Door three has a goat. So one of the two doors has a Ferrari and one has a goat. So what I'm asking you is, do you stick, switch, or does it not matter what you do? All right, Greg, do you stick or do you switch?
In my gut, I might say, oh, I've got a 50-50 chance now, right? Because one of the doors has been eliminated from competition. So maybe it doesn't matter if I switch. That is what my gut, as a human being with misleading biases and beliefs, that's what my human gut is telling me right now.
And that was my original answer when I was first faced with this, and I was unambiguously committed. I have two options. I could switch. I could stick. It doesn't matter because it's a 50-50 chance. And that's where things go sideways on you. Because the statistician in you, Greg, would do what?
Well, the statistician in me would lay out all of the possibilities and then figure out what's left after Monty Hall has revealed some information about what's behind the door. Because I know going into this, I have a 1 in 3 shot. So now the question is whether or not the information that Monty Hall has revealed has changed that at all.
Yep.
So I will tell you without saying anything more, Monty Hall opens one of the other doors. It has a goat. As a statistician, I'm going to switch.
And the tie goes back to the flippier. Do you have information available to you or not? And Greg is correct. You always switch. It's not that it doesn't matter. You always switch. And there are three ways to come to this answer. One is analytically and do the probability, and their website's dedicated to this.
For people who have way too much free time.
Yep. The second, and Greg and I could not recommend strongly enough, of using computer simulation. So you do 1,000 times where you stick, you do 1,000 times where you switch, and you see empirically that always it's better to switch. And indeed, if you switch, your probability goes from 1/3 unconditionally to 2/3. The third way is how a buddy explained it to me, and I understood it. What we don't see with only three doors is there's actually a general rule. You're going to pick one of all the available doors, 1 in 3. The general rule is then Monty Hall is going to open all doors except your door and one other door. Now, that's the general rule, but we don't see it in the three. Imagine Monty Hall brought you up and there were 1,000 doors and you get to pick one and you pick door 53. And there is unambiguously a 1 in 1,000 chance that you have the Ferrari. Now, Monty Hall is going to open 998 doors that have goats. I don't know how they got that many goats, and it's pandemonium in the studio right now. But there are 998 goats. And you have your door, but you have the opportunity to go to the one other door that's still closed. Nobody would say stick in that situation. And so I feel like it's clouded with only having the three doors. Mm-hmm. But the first choice, you have a 1 in 3. When they reveal one door, if you switch, you have a 2 in 3.
I love carrying it out to the absurd to try and get a handle on it. And I think one of the places where people disagreed on this was Monty Hall is not opening some other door at random. He knows what's behind all of the doors. And so he can always choose remaining doors so that it is left between your door and some other door. And maybe you chose the Ferrari in the first time, but obviously it's unlikely. It's unlikely when you have three doors. It's really unlikely when you have 1,000 doors. And he's doing what he can do no matter what the configuration is whatsoever. And that is, he can always open doors that don't contain the Ferrari. And that was really, I think, the crux of where people were having problems and the way that she ultimately explained it in her article around 1990 or so.
So I had fun with the classic Monty Hall problem. Why don't you walk us through the birthday problem? Because this is another one where you squint and cock your head and say, really?
It is. But given our probability skills and what we know about how probability works, we can make sense of these kinds of things. So here's the birthday problem. You have a room that can have any number of people in this room. The question is, how many people would you have in this room to have a 50-50 chance that at least two people have the same birthday? What is your gut sense of that?
Oh, I don't have a gut sense for an actual number other than a lot.
It does feel like a lot, doesn't it? Right? Because there's so many different dates on which people can have a birthday. And just for simplicity, let's keep it to 365 days a year. We know that every once in a while, this year, this year included, a little extra day gets shoehorned in there. But yeah, it feels like we would have to put a lot of people in this room to have at least a 50-50 shot that at least two people would wind up having the same birthday. It turns out, and this is what feels so counterintuitive to a number of people, we only need 23 people in that room to have at least a 50-50 shot that two or more people have the same birthday. And that just kind of blows your mind, right? It doesn't feel right.
That's right. And part of it is you're not saying the probability that two people will have a given birthday.
That's right.
I don't remember the details, but there's a famous late night show and they had a guest on and was talking about the birthday problem and he completely screwed it up. And the host said something like, well, my birthday is May 9th. Who else here has a birthday of May 9th? And the 250 person audience, nobody had a birthday on May 9th. And he was like, oh, well, I guess it doesn't work. And that's not the birthday problem. The birthday problem is everybody says their birthday, and with 23 people, there's a 50-50 chance two will be the same.
Exactly right. For one person in the room, 365 different birth dates that person could have. Now I put the second person in the room. The probability that the second person has the same birthday as the first person, there are a couple different ways to think about this. One is, well, then the second person has a 1 out of 365 chance of being able to match that first person. Another way to think about it, which is useful as we start putting more people in the room, is not just thinking about the probability that two people have the same birthday. We could think about it as 1 minus the probability that they don't. If there's two people in the room, the chance that the second person has a different birth date is 364 out of 365. So that's the chance that they have different birth dates. The chance that they have the same birthday would be 1 minus that, which again comes to 1 out of 365. The reason I introduce that is now I say I've got three people in the room. What's the chance that at least two of those people have the same birth date? Well, let's think about it as 1 minus the chance that they don't. So the first person has whatever their birth date is. Second person can't match that first person. So that person has 364 out of 365 chance. The third person can't match either of them, so their birth date has to be 1 of 363 out of 365 possibilities. So the probability of them not having the same birth date is going to be the 364 over 365 times the 363 over 365. That's the probability of them having different birth dates. So 1 minus that will be the probability of at least two people having the same birth date. And that's a really small number. That comes out to be 0.008 as a probability, less than a 1% chance if you got three people in the room. But if I add a fourth person and a fifth person and a sixth person, and I go through this exact thing, that second person has 364 out of 365. That third person, 363 out of 365. Those are all the probabilities of them having different birth dates. Multiply all those together and take 1 minus it. When I hit 23, it comes out to be around a 0.5 probability. It just crests over. In fact, if we kept throwing people in the room, and again, this might not feel intuitive, but if you go through the exact process that we're talking about, what is 1 minus the probability that no one in the room has the same birth date? If I have 39 people in the room, that doesn't feel like a whole lot, right? You might teach classes out there with 39 people in the room. You have a 90% chance that at least 2 people in the room have the same birth date.
I love that description. And it reminds me of a dad joke, and it reminds me of this really esoteric thing that maybe it might arise in our daily life. The dad joke is, how do you carve an elephant? And it's simple. You get a block of wood and cut off anything that doesn't look like an elephant.
Uh-huh.
And that's what you're doing.
Uh-huh.
The second thought that comes to mind is, oh, I don't know, maybe there's this really esoteric, rare, weird thing that we might once in a blue moon encounter in our day job, which is of a set of p-values on hypothesis tests, what's the probability at least one is a type 1 error, right? Family-wise alpha. So let's say that you do 10 t-tests, just simplifying. Any given t-test has an alpha 0.05, that it is a type 1 error. That is that we're rejecting the null when the null is actually true. But doing the very same mathematics that Greg is describing, with 10 tests, the probability that at least one of the 10 is a type 1 error is actually 0.40%.
Wow.
This is not just a parlor trick at a party. This is a clear and present danger for our day job.
Yeah. Now, admittedly, it's one of the less popular tables at the Bellagio,
the family-wise.
Family-wise error rate table. Yeah. Not a huge draw, honestly.
The type 1 EA error.
That's the acid kicking in, people. All right, so the last probability example that I want to do is really a public service announcement, and that has to do with the lottery. It varies from country to country. It varies from the United States, from state to state. But there's often a national level lottery that is usually something like, and we're going to go with this, there are 48 balls in a tumbler or like a big jar. And some certified lottery official picks out 6 completely at random without replacement. So they have to be different balls. They cannot be the same number. It's called a pick 6. And if anybody guesses the exact 6 numbers that were drawn out of that jar, then you win some huge amount of money. And so people spend lots of money doing this, right? They will go buy their lottery tickets. And when the lottery gets more and more money in the pool, you can see people lined up at the counter at different stores putting down their money.
Tonight, it's the big one. The Mega Millions jackpot, now the largest in its history, soaring to more than $1.5 billion. From California to Michigan, Missouri to New York, everyone lining up.
Let's use this as an example. We have 48 balls in a jar. What is the probability that we pick these 6? If you think about it, on the first choice, there are 6 out of 48 that you could choose that would be one of the chosen ones. So the first one, 6 out of 48 is the probability that your first guess is a correct one. Now there are only 5 choices left for you to make that could be one of those winning numbers. So the probability that the second one you have, 5 out of 47. And the probability of the third one getting it right, well, there's only 4 correct in the remaining 46. So 4 out of 46 for the third one, and 3 out of 45 for the fourth one, 2 out of 44 for the fifth one. And the very last one, there are 43 possible choices left. If you're going to get all 6 right, you have to nail that 1 out of the 43. So the probability that you have guessed all of these random numbers right is 6 over 48 times 5 over 47 times 4 over 46 times 3 over 45 times 2 over 44 times 1 over 43. The grand total of probability here is 1 out of 12,271,512. Okay. Now, that is essentially like the population of São Paulo, Brazil, right? Some giant city. It's bigger than the population of New York City proper, right? New York City proper is like 9 million. So what this is essentially saying is you are handing somebody some money, and then they're going to go to a massive city, pick one person out, and proclaim that person the winner. The probability is infinitesimal, right? So when people put down money, I think they don't generally have an appreciation how absolutely unlikely it is that they're going to win. And lotteries facilitate this by saying, hey, someone's got to win.
So you're telling me there's a chance? Yeah!
But the chance that it's you is almost nothing.
Oh boy, this makes me think of so many things. One is the famous Churchill line when he was talking about the Battle of Britain, where Germany was launching air raids every night for months on end. And he said that the British people had to deal with the fact that there was a probability of near one that someone would die tonight, but of near zero that it would be them. And I thought that was a fascinating statement on that.
Brilliant.
But what I find interesting is I have family members on my wife's side who play the lottery, and it just brings them enjoyment.
Yep.
It's a dollar. They get it. They put it on the fridge. They announce on the TV. They look together. And so there's just an enjoyment to it. Whenever I am the voice of reason, you know that things have gone south in a hurry.
That's just bad. Yeah.
My wife bought her dad gag lottery tickets that you scraped off and it said you won $100,000, and I made her throw them away.
I'm sorry. I adore your wife. Oh, what a horrible gift.
And she was like, but it's funny. And I'm like, if no. I am the one drawing a line in the sand, is something has gone horribly wrong.
Oh, yeah.
But here's what's interesting. People will not choose 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 because that is so unlikely to happen.
When is that going to happen?
Well, yeah. No, that would never happen. I'm going to pick, you know, 32 and 16 and 45.
My mom's
right?
birthday.
No, exactly.
My junior high school locker combination. And
so right. You are just as likely to win, or more appropriately, lose with any set of numbers, because numbers are truly random.
Yeah, but know what you're getting yourself into probabilistically. So Patrick said it, I think, really well. If you get a dollar's worth of enjoyment out of buying that ticket, then God bless you. You go buy that ticket. But just know the largest college football stadium in the United States, University of Michigan, holds a little over 100,000 people. Imagine you had 120 of those stadiums. One person in one stadium is going to win. That's your chance of winning. So you enjoy that dollar. If you would get more enjoyment taking that dollar and burning it right in front of yourself or flushing it down a toilet, you can do that too, either way. But we just want you to know what you're getting yourself into, and more importantly, why the probability is what it is. And we hope that we've given you some ways to think about the probabilities that might be counterintuitive so that they're a little bit less counterintuitive along the way.
And it is infinitely more fun to buy a lottery ticket if you're on acid.
On that note.
Thank you, everybody.
All right. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much for joining us. Don't forget to tell your friends to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever they go to listen to something while they're on the bus heading to the casino, where they're really going to win big this time. I just know it. You can also follow us on the platform formerly known as Twitter, where we are at Quantitude Pod, and visit our website, quantitudepod.org, where you can leave us a message, find organized playlists and show notes and syllabi, listen to past episodes, and other fun stuff. And finally, check out our cool Quantitude merch, like shirts, mugs, stickers, and spiral notebooks from redbubble.com, where all proceeds from non-bootleg authorized merch go to donorschoose.org to help support low-income schools. You've been listening to Quantitude, the podcast version of The Gambler's Fallacy. Listening hasn't paid off in so long, it just feels like it's due to pay off soon, right? Today's episode has been sponsored by other fun and less fun probabilities. The Pick 6 lottery we talked about in the episode, where you have to identify 6 out of 48 numbers, had a 1 in about 12 million chance of winning. The popular Mega Millions jackpot involves picking 5 numbers out of 70, plus another 1 out of 25, for a total chance of winning of 1 in over 300 million. That's one lucky person out of 3,000 full University of Michigan football stadiums. Go Blue. On the other hand, if I give my phone to a monkey with the standard keypad open, what is the probability that he pushes 10 numbers and calls you? Well, it's about 1 in 62 billion, so you're pretty safe. How about if I have a randomly ordered deck of 52 playing cards?
What's the chance that you shuffle a deck of cards and you stop after as many shuffles as you want, and that the order of your cards matches the order of my cards? Well, it's a number that's kind of hard to get your head around. It's about 1 in 10 to the 67th power, which is also called 1 in 10 unvigintillion, which coincidentally is about the same probability that you made it all the way to this point in the episode. But it's still bigger than the probability that this is NPR, which it most definitely is not.